called What If They Held an Election and Everyone Came? This is by Christopher Hooks. How Texas's 150-year history of voter suppression has brought us to this moment and what we can do to save our elections. If the health of a democracy can be measured by how many citizens participate in the political process, Texas has lupus. Voter turnout rates here range from very bad to abysmal. In 2014, just 28% of eligible Texas voters cast a ballot, a record low, placing the state in 48th in the national ranking. Thank you, Indiana. Thank you, New York. Turnout has grown since then at a rate that had shocked many observers, yet even the unusually busy 2018 midterms resulted in us soaring to 42nd in the nation. If that wounds your Texas pride, know that thriving elections have never been of particular concern to state leaders. Rather, dismal participation rates are a feature, not a bug. The system is working, just as those in power want it to work. In some nations, elections are sacred, and governments go to great lengths to encourage and even mandate voting. In Australia, run by a center-right government, turnout in federal elections is north of 90%. Through their actions, state leaders have long showed that they believe too many Texans are voting, rather than too few, and that voting is too convenient and safe, rather than too burdensome and risky. This long-running attempt to correct for the problem of too much democracy has taken many forms, so many that it can be difficult to keep up with them all. But the activity has intensified in the last few years. Texas Republicans have attempted to purge voter rolls, forced polling places to close, fought to keep voter registration difficult, and punished minor violations of election law with draconian prison sentences. But most astonishingly, state leaders have worked tirelessly this year to ensure that most voters will have to cast ballots in person during a once-in-a-century pandemic that has already killed more than 16,000 Texans. Early in the COVID-19 crisis, some local election administrators sought to make mail ballots widely available, in line with the recommendations of all credible public health experts. With months to go, state government could have worked with local officials to figure out how to address the relatively minor issues around ballot security. Instead, Attorney General Ken Paxton and the Republican Party of Texas have fought every step of the way to stop the expansion of mail-in voting beyond the elderly, disabled, and those in jail, knowing that the fall may see another big spike in infections. In good times, Texas government officials seek to make voting difficult. In this very bad year, they're making it a death-defying act. All these actions are couched by the GOP as an attempt to keep elections fair and eliminate voter fraud. Republicans, of course, have run Texas for almost two decades. If there's widespread fraud in Texas elections, one would think they'd have found it by now and fixed it. But they profess to have made no headway in eliminating the threat. As with the Chupacabra, voter fraud is greatly feared, but rarely seen. The 2020 election looks to be one of the most severe stress tests American democracy has ever faced, and it's the most up-in-the-air election Texas has seen in decades. With control of the legislature and a raft of competitive congressional districts in play, and the Democratic presidential nominee polling here within the margin of error, it's vital that the machinery of democracy isn't gummed up, that the results can be trusted, and that the popular will is followed. Instead, Texas, like much of the nation, has been buried by an election year avalanche of legal wrangling, double talk, and subterfuge that threaten to cloud the results and undermine trust in the process. How the hell did we get here? The Declaration of Independence avers that government is only legitimate if it enjoys the consent of the governed. But for much of U.S. history, it hasn't worked that way. Instead, the people have had to seek consent from the political party in power to participate. When consent is denied, we call that voter suppression. Such disenfranchisement can take many forms. It can be overt, a poll tax or a literacy test, or it can be more subtle, such as the way local officials in rural Waller County have curbed voting hours and limited the number of polling places to blunt the influence of students at the historically black Prairie View A&M University. We identify voter suppression by its effect, not its exact form. It prevents those at the bottom of this country's complex social hierarchy, people of color, the working class, the young, from exercising the most important right conferred on them by U.S. citizenship. Voter suppression and other methods of swaying election results from outright fraud to gerrymandering aren't an occasional feature of Texas politics. They form a continuous thread. The state has never been free of them. You probably know how the story starts. In the years after the Civil War, the 15th Amendment and the Union Army briefly enfranchised black men. For a time, Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party had the upper hand in Texas, electing African Americans to office in the years after the end of the Civil War. In response, Texas Democrats built a legal regime to disenfranchise freedmen. The blunt instruments of disenfranchisement included poll taxes and the white primary laws, which borrowed African Americans and Hispanics from participating in the all-important Democratic nominating contest. But by 1965, the party system had undergone a dramatic shift. It was a Texas Democrat, Lyndon Johnson, who presided over the defeat of Jim Crow in the voting booth, or so it was hoped, with the signing of the Voting Rights Act. The bill established something approaching universal suffrage in the United States for the first time in its history, and it gave the federal government the teeth to enforce it. But it wasn't the clean break with the past that its advocates had hoped for. The disease had already mutated, and a new kind of voter suppression had taken shape to replace the one Congress had made illegal. In 1964, the Republican National Committee organized a nationwide expansion of a poll-watching campaign called Operation Eagle Eye, building on ballot security initiatives by the same name run by local Republican parties in the years before. Republicans were convinced, not unreasonably, that the 1960 presidential election had been stolen from Richard Nixon thanks to Richard Daley's Chicago political machine and Lyndon Johnson's under-the-table influence in his home state. This was, after all, the state where a South Texas political boss known as the Duke of Duval helped steal the 1948 Senate election for Johnson. From this legitimate fear came Eagle Eye, or Evil Eye, as Democratic Vice President Hubert Humphrey called it. Republicans claimed to put 100,000 poll watchers in precincts across the nation in 1964, focused on large cities with high concentrations of minority and working class voters. The Indianapolis Star reported that a pert Republican housewife was on hand to sternly supervise LBJ's own vote in Johnson City. The New York Times reported that the director of the operation, Charles Barr, expected to successfully challenge or discourage from voting 1,250,000 persons, and quoted Barr as denying that there was anything discriminatory in Eagle Eye against any race, creed, or economic status. During his U.S. Supreme Court confirmation process, future Chief Justice William Rehnquist was accused of intimidating voters in Arizona's Maricopa County as part of Eagle Eye during the 1962 election, where a federal judge later wrote, "Every black or Mexican person was challenged to read the Constitution in English and then to interpret it." Rehnquist himself reportedly administered the test. Republican Party organized an estimated 10,000 poll watchers in Texas in 1964, or 1 in 10 of the national number, a remarkable figure given that the GOP was still virtually irrelevant in Texas. That year, flyers authored by the non-existent Harris County Negro Protective Association warned black voters they could be arrested for voting if they had even so much as been questioned by the police for any offense, including traffic violations. The chairman of the Harris County GOP charged that the party had found more than 1,000 fictitious voter registrations. In Travis County, Republicans said they found 100 phantom voters circulating pictures of a cemetery in a vacant lot where they were apparently registered. When the Austin American looked into the allegations, they found simple clerical errors. In each case, the address was off by a single digit. The pattern set that year would repeat time and again in Texas. Whenever the Democratic Party's fortunes are on the upswing, fear of voter fraud tends to get whipped up. That was the case in 1964 and again in 2008. The latter year, Texas Democrats nearly took control of the state house and Barack Obama won Harris County by a thin margin, a watershed event for Democrats trying to claw their way back to relevancy. One of the most worried observers was Catherine Engelbrecht, a white Houston woman who co-owns an oilfield machinery company and founded the King Street Patriots, a Tea Party group. After Obama's win, she told the New York Times later, "Something clicked," and she saw a future for the United States that threatened the future of our children. So in the city's 2009 municipal elections, she and a few dozen like-minded activists volunteered as poll workers, particularly in non-white parts of town. Engelbrecht says she witnessed widespread fraud, but many of the activities she claims to have seen were in fact legally required, such as poll workers helping voters fill out their ballots upon request. Nonetheless, Engelbrecht's account made her an overnight celebrity. With more volunteers and more backing, King Street Patriots scoured voter rolls in predominantly black parts of Houston and came up with a list of what they called fraudulent registration forms. That caught the attention of Harris County tax assessor, collector, and voter registrar Leo Vasquez, a Republican. On August 24, 2010, Vasquez held a shocking press conference in a room filled with cheering members of Engelbrecht's new group, True the Vote. Vasquez announced that the faulty registration forms came from Houston Votes 2010, a nonprofit that was attempting to register 100,000 new voters in Harris County before the November election. The integrity of the voter roll of Harris County, Texas, appears to be under an organized and systemic attack by Houston Votes, Vasquez said. Some 5,000 voter registration forms turned in by the group were fraudulent, he claimed. Non-citizens and minors were attempting to register to vote, he said. Crimes may have been committed. But the explosive claims added up to very little. Houston Votes, as it turned out, was the only real victim. Some of the group's paid canvassers had been turning in junk work, registration forms that were incomplete or duplicates. Ultimately, it was Vasquez's job to screen out ineligible voters. All he had to do was throw away the faulty applications, which were easy to spot. For instance, consider those applications from non-citizens, which featured so prominently in news coverage. There's a box on the form that asks if the applicant is a citizen. Applicants had checked no. The Duke of Duval, they were not. With the specter of voter fraud hanging over the 2010 election, armed agents from the office of Greg Abbott, then the state attorney general, raided the headquarters of Houston Votes and seized everything they could, computers, financial records, paperwork. They kneecapped the organization. It fell far short of its registration goals and disbanded soon after, unable to raise money. True the Vote, meanwhile, sent an even larger contingent of poll watchers to minority precincts where they set about pestering citizens. After driven a stake through the heart of Houston Votes, the AG's office quietly determined that no one had committed any crimes at all. Rather than issue a heartfelt apology, the investigators destroyed all the group's seized property. Voter lists, computers, financial records. Abbott's attorneys also neglected to tell the group's leaders that they had been cleared. The Houston Votes saga received little attention at the time. As with this year, there were simply too many election shenanigans going on at once for the episode to get much attention. But it was a particularly egregious case, even for Texas. If the episode had happened in Ukraine, the U.S. State Department, at least before 2017, would have loudly condemned it. In the years since, True the Vote has prospered, receiving millions of dollars in funding from right-wing donors to expand its operations. This year, Engelbrecht aims to mobilize 10,000 poll watchers with a special emphasis on recruiting military veterans. Her poll watchers have often been accused of harassment, as she explained behind closed doors at a recent gathering of the religious right in Orange County, California. She wants intimidating-looking volunteers. You get some Navy SEALs in those polls, and they're going to say, no, this is what it says. This is how we're going to play this show, she says. Engelbrecht and those like her are behaving in a rational way. In a state that has rarely celebrated or protected the act of voting, it makes sense to prevent your enemies from exercising their franchise. They're also following tradition. At a 1980 gathering of Christian conservatives in Dallas, at which future President Ronald Reagan spoke, prominent activist and organizer Paul Weyrich ridiculed Christians who were infected with what he called goo-goo syndrome, which is to say they believed in good government ideals such as getting more Americans to vote. I don't want everybody to vote, he said. Our leverage in the election goes up as the voting populace goes down. Weyrich wasn't some crank. He was a co-founder of the Moral Majority, the Heritage Foundation, and the American Legislative Exchange Council, among other groups. Alec later became instrumental in helping state legislatures put up new impediments to voting, including Texas's 2011 voter ID law, one of the strictest in the nation. Heritage Foundation maintains a database of what it calls proven instances of election fraud. It totals 1,298 cases over two decades, many of which concern improper handling of a single ballot or non-voting related offenses like petition gathering, a laughably small number in a country where 130 million ballots are cast in each presidential election. Many conservative activists feel as Weyrich did. In 2013, Texas Tea Party leader Ken Emanuelson was asked at a Dallas County GOP event how the Republican Party was reaching out to black voters. I'm going to be real honest with you, Emanuelson said. The Republican Party doesn't want black people to vote if they're going to vote 9-1 for Democrats. In 2017, President-elect Donald Trump told a group of civil rights leaders that many blacks didn't go out and vote for Hillary because they liked me. That was almost as good as getting the vote. On August 10, 2006, a 69-year-old black woman named Gloria Meeks was toweling off after taking a bath at her home in Fort Worth when she said, "Two men peeped into my bathroom window, not once, but twice." In time, she would learn that the men staking out her house were investigators from Texas Attorney General Abbott's office, part of a team looking into what Abbott billed as an epidemic of voter fraud. Meeks's crime? She had helped a homebound 79-year-old neighbor fill out her mail-in ballot and then walked it to the post box two blocks away. By mailing the ballot for her neighbor without signing on the back of the envelope, Meeks had violated the law. In the course of the investigation, which never led to any charges, Meeks had a stroke, which her friends blamed partly on stress. That year, as Republican poll numbers were slipping, Abbott's team, funded by a $1.5 million federal grant dispersed by then-Governor Rick Perry, went after dozens of alleged mail ballot fraudsters, primarily Democrats and people of color, and they were often senior citizens born in the age of the white primary and the poll tax. Was that by design? A PowerPoint presentation that Abbott's office used to brief officeholders on electoral fraud included a picture of black voters in line under the heading "Poll Place Violations." Fraud detectives, the PowerPoint said, should look out for unique stamps accompanying mail-in ballots. The example given is a 2004 stamp with the words "Test Early for Sickle Cell" over a picture of a black woman kissing an infant. Sickle cell anemia is disproportionately common among people of African ancestry. It's enough to make one wonder if the fear of voter fraud is sincere. The last few years have seen, once again, the fortunes of the Democratic Party rising relative to those of the Republican Party in Texas. Part of the reason is increased voter turnout. So, naturally, fears of voter fraud and attempts to depress turnout are on the upswing. In 2019, Texas Secretary of State David Whitley instructed local officials to investigate some 100,000 Texans who his office suggested had voted illegally. The purge fell apart when it turned out the list was junk and included many naturalized citizens who had every right to vote. The state has fought to keep voter registration harder than it needs to be, sometimes in contravention of federal law. In August, a federal judge rebuked Texas, yet again, for violating federal motor voter laws, which requires the Department of Motor Vehicles to offer voter registration when driver's licenses are renewed. And in 2019, the legislature effectively prohibited the use of temporary voting sites during early voting, which were of particular use on college campuses. Lawmakers have also kept up an aggressive campaign to punish minor violations of election law with severe sentences. Most infamous of these cases involves Crystal Mason, a black mother of three from Fort Worth who was on supervised release for a felony tax fraud charge when she cast a provisional ballot in the 2016 presidential election. Unbeknownst to her, that was illegal. She had to wait until the end of supervised release to vote. Her ballot was rejected and never counted. Yet she was nonetheless convicted of voting illegally and sentenced to 5 years in jail. Even the one concession Governor Abbott made to facilitate voting during COVID-19, extending early voting by a week, was too much for the Republican Party. Together with a long list of Republican office holders, the party sued to prevent polls from opening up early, arguing that the governor was required to consult the legislature before giving voters more time to cast their ballots. Perhaps in response, on October 1st, Abbott ordered Texas counties to limit themselves to one drop-off location for mail-in ballots, making it harder, especially in urban counties, for voters who are wary of Trump's tampering with the U.S. Post Office to turn in their ballots in person. While the Republican Party can at least claim that mail-in ballots are vulnerable to voter fraud, there's no justification for preventing in-person early voting other than to drive down turnout. With one hand, the state GOP is fighting in the courts to prevent local election officials from sending mail-in ballot applications to the public. With the other, it is sending mail-in ballot applications to its own voters, accompanied by campaign literature featuring a big picture of President Trump. Around the time the application started to go out, Trump encouraged his own supporters to try voting twice, once by mail and once in person, to see if their mail-in ballot had been counted. Don't try this, folks. It's illegal. In other words, there's precisely one major elected official in America who has endorsed voter fraud this year, and it's the president. Here's the bad news. A 150-year-old habit is going to be tough for Texans to kick. We certainly won't be giving it up before the November election, and that's worrying. But there's good news, too. Unlike lupus, voter suppression is curable. Obstacles intended to suppress voting can be overcome by those determined to exercise their rights, those willing to stand in long lines in bad weather and risk catching COVID-19. Turnout is surging in Texas. It did in 2016 and 2018, and there's reason to believe that 2020 will break records, too. Voter suppression efforts tend to target the working class and people of color. There were fewer impediments to voting in the suburbs, the kinds of places that broke big for Mitt Romney in 2012. Many of those neighborhoods have swung toward the Democratic Party in recent years. That's not the only way that voter suppression might backfire for the GOP. Once it becomes possible to win every election by appealing only to your own voters, there's no reason to go about politics the traditional way, winning the hearts and minds of those who don't already agree with you. The muscles of persuasion atrophy. Once they're gone, they're not so easy to toughen up again. Governor George W. Bush called himself a compassionate conservative. By contrast, a key image of Dan Patrick's border-focused 2014 campaign for lieutenant governor was a padlock on a white picket fence. Every current statewide elected official got there by dishing out red meat. But that leaves the party with thin defenses as the state's politics become more genuinely competitive. The ability of the Republican majority to suppress turnout and influence election results should lessen bit by bit. If Democrats take control of the state house, they'll have a seat at the table in the 2021 round of redistricting, perhaps the most consequential way the legislature shapes election outcomes. Although they'll have much less power than they'd like, the Texas Constitution contains a way for state leaders to override the house and draw legislative districts themselves. Perhaps more important is what is happening at the local level. As the state's most populous counties turn bluer, Democrats are being put in charge of administering elections for more and more in the state's population. Local election officials like interim county clerk Chris Hollins in Harris County, who's been pushing to expand access to mail ballots, have a lot of discretion. Expect the state to try to rein it in more and more. Can the GOP make a course correction? In 2019, Republican donors funded a massive new political action committee called Engage Texas. It was the first time in recent history that any kind of GOP organization had been created to register new voters. Democratic groups, such as the Texas Organizing Project, have been chasing new voters for years, successfully in a state that makes it very difficult for them to do so. Of course, that's because Democrats in Texas, unlike their Republican counterparts, simply haven't had enough of a base to win. They've had no choice but to go looking for new voters. Engage Texas raised almost $13 million and hired hundreds of employees. It was an admission that the landscape had changed and that the old tricks weren't enough anymore. In May, Engage Texas shut down. The group said the coronavirus had made it too hard to engage Texans. But that didn't stop Democratic groups from doing so. It seemed much more likely that the project had met with little success, and that the party had waited too long to begin doing outreach to non-voters. Persuading people to vote for you, it turns out, is harder than keeping them from voting at all. And a little natural spot here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. Its year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, scan 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Back to our text, still with the 2020 election section. This article is entitled, Don't Call Them the Sleeping Giant. It's by Cecilia Bailly. Texas's Latino voters aren't disengaged. They're waiting to be heard and fully understood. You ask him to check a box, Peter Guzman considers himself a Democrat. Yet though he is now 30 years old, he's only voted twice in his life. In 2008, as a senior at McCollum High School on San Antonio's South Side, where he and his family lived for several generations, he heard an assembly lecture about the importance of voting. Inspired by the talk and having just turned 18, he voted for Barack Obama since the charismatic senator from Chicago was promising change. Over the next 8 years, even as Obama went up for a second term, Peter didn't think too much about politics. He voted one more time in the 2014 district attorney's race in Bayard County because some friends were working on the challenger's successful campaign. It wasn't until after Donald Trump's election in 2016 that he started paying more attention. I just personally never liked the guy, and I was shocked to see that he was going to be our president. And he says he began to ask himself, why is it good to be a Democrat? Why is it good to be a Republican? Peter didn't know what either party stood for. Friends and family told him that based on his values, he was probably a Democrat, but he wasn't sure what being a Democrat meant. So he began talking to the only person in his immediate family who did follow politics, his mother-in-law, Josette Salazar. He started watching the news on television and looking up CNN and New York Times stories on his phone apps. In July of last year, as he and his wife, Angel Marie, were waiting for the birth of their first child in the obstetric ward of Southwest General Hospital, he and Josette watched hours of the Robert Mueller hearings together. Josette provided a running commentary that drew him deeper into the drama unfolding on the screen. She insisted to him that his vote mattered, and she urged him to vote again. As of this year, however, he still hasn't. That's thing, he said. I love reading about politics. I love watching it, but I haven't been convinced to actually go out there and vote. Peter isn't alone. The question of why more Latinos aren't voting has consumed politicians, pollsters, and political observers for the past few decades. Latinos make up about 30% of Texans who are eligible to vote, but in recent elections, only about 20% of those who actually cast a ballot. To be sure, Latino voter turnout has been increasing steadily, but Latinos' presence at the ballot box still falls short of its potential. Next year, they're projected to become the largest demographic group in Texas. If they're to turn out in larger numbers, it could swing election outcomes in the state, and given Texas's large role in the Electoral College at the presidential level, too. This is a proverbial sleeping giant that again and again liberals have hoped will help them turn Texas blue. But is sleeping giant the right metaphor to describe Latino voters? Are they really as disengaged as that phrase suggests, or are there deeper reasons why many of them don't vote? And among those who do vote, why don't more of them vote for Democrats as liberals would like? And why are many voting for Donald Trump, a politician who has spoken of Mexican and Central American immigrants as murderers and rapists and as a serious threat to Americans? Over the past year, in an attempt to better understand Latino voters and non-voters, two colleagues, my fellow anthropologist Michael Powell and sociologist Betsabeth Monica Lugo, and I set out across Texas to get to know them. Instead of disseminating multiple-choice surveys as pollsters do, we spent hours conversing one-on-one with more than 100 Latinos who are eligible to vote from five major regions, Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, El Paso, and the Rio Grande Valley. The study was commissioned and funded by the Texas Organizing Project Education Fund, the sister organization of the Texas Organizing Project, the largest grassroots progressive organization in the state. Though the group leans left, the study was nonpartisan, and we were given full independence to design it, let the results be what they may. While our research was focused on what drives civic engagement, not on which candidates Latinos prefer, many participants shared such thoughts with us in the course of our conversations. We asked mostly open-ended questions, trying to get to the heart of the whys more than the whats of Latino voting. All our interviews ran at least 90 minutes long, some stretched to 2 hours. Many of the conversations turned emotional. More than one interviewee shed tears. We also laughed. The depth of the exchanges repeatedly surprised us, and much of what we heard ran counter to some of the most pervasive narratives about Latino voters and non-voters. Peter is a prime example. Here was a young man who reads politics voraciously and who spoke cogently about being racially harassed, about his views of representative democracy, and about his dreams for his then 11-day-old son, and who, it turns out, had even driven by the polls a few times during recent election seasons, but ultimately hadn't felt compelled to get out of his car and cast a vote. Peter often told us that he wanted to feel like he was part of something bigger, something that would bring about change for his family and for his community, but he wasn't convinced that voting would accomplish those things. Well, why was that? Like many Mexican-Americans in San Antonio, Peter has his roots in the city and neighborhoods that run deep. Born and raised on the South Side, never left, he told me proudly last August when we sat down to talk. He's a second-generation American on his father's side, third generation on his mother's side. Studied computer science at San Antonio College after high school, but left after his fourth semester because he no longer qualified for financial aid and already owed more than $20,000 in high-interest student loans. Since then, he had hopped between jobs, working as a grocery stocker at Walmart, convenience store clerk, and most recently a billing clerk at a local produce company. Yet he never made more than $10.50 an hour. He sometimes supplemented his income by working at odd jobs such as mowing lawns, but he and his wife still struggle to get by, especially because he has chronic health problems and has amassed some $10,000 in unpaid medical bills. Peter's been diagnosed with prediabetes, diverticulitis, and high blood pressure, which sometimes cause him to miss work, but he said he can't afford health insurance, which would cost him $132 a month under Obamacare. He wanted to see the government raise the minimum wage and make health care affordable, but like almost all of the non-voters we spoke with, he didn't believe that his vote could help make that happen. I feel like what we vote for and what we say is not what politicians want to hear, he said. I would love to see why our vote matters. I want to see a presentation. I want to sit down and I want them to convince me why is it great to vote. Peter was reflective about other factors that influenced his choice not to vote. He noted that virtually none of his family members have voted. My mom's not a voter. My grandparents are not voters. He said no one's voted. Voting, our study confirmed, is a habit that usually develops over time more than a rational choice. It's a social behavior that's learned and reinforced through example. Tellingly, none of the 24 non-voters we interviewed grew up around parents who voted regularly. Studies show and our research confirm that if your parents go to the polls when you're young, chances are you will become a voter too. We also realize that many of the non-voters we spoke with didn't have a lot of agency over their lives. Peter, for example, hadn't been able to significantly improve his own situation despite his efforts to get an education, work hard, and care for his family. Such feelings of financial stress and being overwhelmed seemed to have a strong dampening effect on voting. We found a high correlation between income and voting frequency among those we interviewed. The more money you make, the more likely you are to vote. Some of the poor and working-class Latinos we interviewed were often struggling to respond to crises, and they focused their attention on the immediate issues they could make better. Being poor really doesn't lend itself to fixing major problems, said Juan Flores, a 27-year-old non-voter we interviewed in Brownsville. Government seemed distant, and many struggled to directly connect its policies and actions to their lives. The futility they experienced in other areas often paralleled how they spoke about voting and politicians. May partly explain why the border regions in San Antonio, a city whose Mexican-Americans have a long history of racial segregation and inequality, have lower Latino turnout than, say, Dallas or Houston, where there's more economic mobility. Indeed, feeling empowered and having a general sense of belonging emerged as themes that repeatedly distinguished voters from non-voters. Non-voters tend to be surrounded by other non-voters. They aren't sure their vote matters, and they don't feel that people in power care about their experiences or perspective. By contrast, voters often discuss politics with other voters. They believe they have a right to be heard, they are better able to directly relate government policy to their lives, and they believe they can influence political outcomes. It's almost as if voters and non-voters live in two different worlds. One common misconception is that Latinos don't vote in larger numbers because many of them are immigrants. But nationwide statistics show that naturalized Latino and Asian American citizens turn out at a somewhat higher rate than their U.S.-born peers. We observe that when a family doesn't vote across multiple generations, the habit of non-voting can become more entrenched. Non-voting is an American problem, not an immigrant problem. Over the past 8 years, Texas has closed hundreds of polling sites, and some research shows that this disproportionately hurts Latinos. Only two of our interviewees mentioned voting hassles as an issue, however, and one of them managed to vote anyway, despite his usual polling place being shuttered. While making it harder to vote surely discourages voting, it didn't seem to be one of the primary reasons our interviewees didn't go to the polls. Those reasons were more deeply rooted. But non-voters, even those with strong doubts about the political system, can turn into voters, and this too we wanted to better understand. People become politicized in many ways, through school, through work, by joining community or activist organizations, or even by watching political news that drives home the importance of voting. Non-voters can be convinced to vote by politically engaged peers, and it can be moved to action by a personal experience that makes clear how specific laws are hurting them. When we met Claudia Perez in summer 2019, she was 36 years old and doing full-time, doing freelance administrative work for apartment companies. Claudia, who lives in the same northwest Houston neighborhood of Spring Branch where she grew up, is also a full-time mom. She has four children who now range in age from 7 to 17, and she serves on the board of the PTA of all three of her kids' schools. She's the daughter of Mexican immigrants, and her Panamanian husband, Jose, works in hotel maintenance. Together, they earn a modest working-class income that they manage carefully. Like Peter, Claudia has not grown up around anyone who voted. Her parents, who are naturalized citizens, long thought that voting didn't make a difference based on their experiences of elections in Mexico, which they regarded as corrupt. first, Claudia herself didn't pay much attention to politics, but in 2003, when she was 21 years old and married Jose, she learned how immigration laws were hamstringing his life. Not only was he unable to attend his father's funeral in Panama as he awaited his legal status, but applying for his residency turned into an onerous experience. Even filling out the application was a whole ordeal, she said. She enrolled in technical school to get a higher-paying job because the government required that she earn a certain amount of money to petition on his behalf. It's just a lot of things that became very real. The next civics lesson came when Claudia's children enrolled in school. She wanted to make sure they were getting the best education they could, so she started spending time on campus and soon learned how greatly the decisions that school administrators make affect their students. So she joined the PTAs. By the time I met her, she was serving as a treasurer for one, secretary for another, and vice president for the third. When she invited other Latino parents to the meetings, however, they were reluctant to go. She realized they didn't feel like they belonged there or as if their views would matter to administrators. They'd be very surprised that you can really change what a principal is doing or how they're treating your children, Claudia said. She started organizing potlucks and Loteria nights where the winners walked away with gift baskets. Now we got parents in. Trust me, they come. Claudia said that immigration and gun control were, for her, the most urgent policy issues at the moment, and she was highly critical of how Donald Trump had treated immigrants. When I asked her about the election, which was then still more than a year away, she laughed and said, "I know who I'm not voting for." Yet, even though her policy interests and positions seem to align with those of the Democratic Party, and she has never voted for a Republican candidate, Claudia is not a Democrat. She doesn't adhere to any partisan labels, despite the fact that she votes in almost every local, state, national election. Instead, she assesses elections based on what issues she prioritizes at that moment and who she thinks is offering a better solution. "I can't tell you that I'm a Republican or a Democrat," she said. Claudia reflected a larger and, to us, unexpected trend. Latinos often don't identify in strongly partisan ways, even when they consistently vote for one party. Despite the intense, almost tribal partisanship that dominates politics in the country today, many of the voters we spoke with considered themselves independent. Numerous polls suggest that anywhere from 60 to 70% of Latinos identify as Democrats and 30 to 40% of Republicans, but those polls identify people by their ideological tendencies, even if they don't formally affiliate with a party. By contrast, we kept finding Latinos who didn't consider themselves to have an affiliation. And even many of the Democrats and a few of the Republicans said they were open to candidates and arguments from both parties. There are several reasons Latinos aren't highly partisan, we found. First, neither party historically has engaged them to a great degree, certainly not to the extent that the Democratic Party has targeted black voters, for example, or the way Republicans have catered to evangelical Christians. The majority of people we interviewed has never been contacted by campaigns or met a political candidate, not even those individuals whose elected officials are Latino. They also felt a general disconnect with candidates and leaders who they believe rarely understand or speak to their struggles beyond the issue of immigration. Second, most Latinos don't come from families where generations have voted for the same party or voted at all, passing on that loyalty to their children. Third, a considerable number of Latinos hold ideologically mixed views on policy issues from abortion to gun control to immigration, which can overlap with the positions of both parties. These are people who could, in theory anyway, be swayed by compelling arguments from either side of the aisle. And finally, we found a small group of mostly younger, college-educated voters who call themselves independent because they feel the two-party system has failed and isn't properly representing everyone's interests. Many political observers and organizers expect Latinos to side with Democrats because of the party's immigration policies, but across the political spectrum, we observed relatively moderate views about immigration. Hardly anyone we spoke with was calling for open borders, a policy that the Republican Party frequently claims Democrats and Latinos favor. Most of our interviewees emphasized very strongly with migrants, but felt equally strong that immigration needs to be legal and orderly. Andrea Daniela Mata is a young independent from El Paso, but her views on immigration were reflective of the Democrats and Republicans we met with. "I would say there needs to be more regulation," she said, "but you can't have people wait for years and years and years to apply." Following the law was important to most of the people we spoke with, but they also felt it was essential that the system be respectful of people and be transparent, and that the government make it easier for some immigrants to come to the United States. Across party lines, they wanted deferred action for childhood arrivals recipients to be fully legalized, and while immigration was a top concern for many, it alone did not determine whether or how they vote. Of course, despite the large number of independent voters we encountered, a majority of Latinos do vote Democratic. In general, the Democrats we spoke with talked about how the country and the government should provide opportunity to more people. Many were viscerally affected, even traumatized, by recent separation of families at the border and by the 2019 shooting of 46 shoppers at an El Paso Walmart, which they blamed on anti-Latino racism they felt Trump has perpetuated. One 36-year-old woman in San Antonio broke into tears as soon as I began the interview. "I'm getting a little emotional," said Monica Vega. "I think this year, with everything that's happening, I feel that our people should be voting because it's not right. Trump is supposed to be for the people, and he's not. What kind of person allows people to be caged up like animals? We treat our dogs better than we treat people." Racism was a major theme in a number of our interviews. Many people struggled to put a name on it. When pressed, almost everyone had experienced discrimination or had been treated differently due to their ethnicity. The message that Latinos don't belong in society can subconsciously discourage them from voting, but it can also be a catalyst to get some people involved in the electoral process. Many voters told us that Trump's disparagement of Latino immigrants made this a crucial election for them, and they felt more conviction than ever about voting. And yet, for roughly every two Latinos in Texas who vote Democrat, one votes Republican, even when that Republican is Donald Trump. And these individuals are perhaps the least understood of all. Angel Avila arrived to our interview in El Paso after a long day of work, apologizing for running a little late. Dressed in the dark coveralls of his trade, he gave off an air of quiet responsibility and respect. Angel, who was 25 years old that October, was in his fourth year of a five-year apprenticeship program to become a journeyman electrician, following in the footsteps of his father, a master electrician, and his grandfather. He is a proud member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local Union 583. "My plan was not to follow in my father's footsteps, but that's just how the chips fell," he said, smiling. His parents, naturalized citizens from the Mexican border state of Chihuahua, are a poster couple for economic mobility. Starting with very little, they each earned bachelor's and master's degrees as adults and eventually settled in the verdant Upper Valley on El Paso's west side, where they live in a large, handsome brick home. Now it was Angel's turn to work his way up the socioeconomic ladder, and he was working very hard at it. On top of his job, he was taking classes that he hoped would lead to an electrical engineering degree. He has a few learning disabilities that make schoolwork challenging, so he sometimes puts in double shifts with his tutor. Since we spoke, he obtained his license and now works full-time as an electrician. Angel's political awakening began in 2016 when he attended a Bernie Sanders campaign rally at the invitation of a friend, a DACA recipient who was volunteering at the event. When Angel, whose father is a Republican, heard Sanders speak, he realized he didn't agree with what he was hearing. Sanders was saying the minimum wage should be raised to $15 an hour, but Angel wasn't sure if the economy could support that and whether that was fair to people like him. "Okay, you want to raise up the minimum wage, you want to help all these people out," he said, "but I'm over here struggling day in and day out, paying my school out of my own pocket and working my ass off just to be where I'm at. I'm not saying don't raise up the minimum wage. I'm saying there has to be a fair number to raise it up to." He did research on whether a higher minimum wage could impact small businesses. Places get affected. They can't pay their employees. It's way too high, and a lot more people lose their job. That November, Angel cast the first vote of his life supporting Donald Trump for president. There are many theories as to why some Latinos vote Republican. One common explanation is that they're social conservatives who oppose abortion and gun control. Some left-leaning Latinos accuse them of rejecting their roots. And then there's the theory, drawing on age-old stereotypes, that Latino men seem more Republican than women because of supposed machismo. But our interviews didn't fully bear those theories out. Certainly, we interviewed conservative Christians who are single-issue voters on abortion, but they were a minority among the Republicans we met, and the vast majority of our interviewees embraced their ethnicity and culture. As for the issue of machismo, many of Trump's supporters said that they liked his toughness, but that group included women. And it's not at all clear that this is any different than the attitude prevalent among his white supporters. Instead, what most commonly distinguished the Republicans we spoke with from more liberal Latinos was their view of the meaning of opportunity and the government's role in creating it. They tended to speak about limited resources, and they questioned whether the government providing money and other forms of assistance to the less well-off would affect their own well-being. Many of them did feel that the government should offer support to certain groups, such as the elderly, but for everyone else, they wanted public assistance to be temporary and not become a way of life. Particularly in El Paso and the Rio Grande Valley, Republicans and even many Democrats spoke critically about individuals they feel are gaming the system by accessing benefits they're not entitled to. Angel offered the example of residents from Ciudad Juarez, who he said get financial aid at the University of Texas in El Paso, despite coming from middle-class families, since the school doesn't verify their parents' income. Government leaders, Angel said, want to give, 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 but who are you taking from? You're taking more from the middle class. He added, I'd rather hold my head up high than ask for a handout, and I understand that people do need help, but I see that a lot of people take advantage of that system. Among several younger working class men we interviewed, the sense of having to compete in the job market with immigrants was also a very real concern. They admired immigrants' work ethic and skills, but one of them said that immigrants are easier to take advantage of because their legal status makes them vulnerable. If you were a boss and you headed a company, would you pay me $100 or would you pay five other people $20? Said another young man, Fernando Morales of San Antonio. In Angel's experience, the competition came from unlicensed electricians who were trained in Mexico, which is why he was thankful that he was part of the union, which offered wage protections and benefits. He conceded that the Republican Party isn't particularly supportive of unions, but he said that his co-workers vote for both parties. Angel also identifies as a Republican because he staunchly supports gun rights. He owns several guns, including an AR-15, which he uses to target shoot, like a number of other El Pasoans we interviewed. I feel like what we need to do instead of trying to take guns from people is teach people how to respect the weapon, he said. That's the big thing my dad showed me and my sister. He believes that people who want to cause harm will get their hands on weapons, whether the weapons are legal or not. And he noted that in Mexico, guns are common despite being outlawed. In short, the attitudes and values of Republicans resonated with Angel, as they did with his father. Republicans represent the old-school American. Make your own way, you sink or swim, he explained. He was satisfied with Trump's performance on the job, even if he didn't agree with everything the president says or does. I like more of his business side, he said, echoing other Republicans we spoke with. I don't like how he speaks, but he follows through on everything he says. I like that I know what I'm getting. As for Democrats' accusation that Trump is a racist, Angel replied, I think everybody's racist in a way, but I don't feel like he's super racist. Like Angel, many of the other Republicans we interviewed had supported Trump in 2016 because they liked that he wasn't a career politician, and that he called things as he saw them, even if some felt that he was often too brash or crass. One 36-year-old Republican woman in San Antonio who asked for anonymity said the only way for Trump to fix the country's problems was through hard love and putting his foot down. As for his immigration policies, we met one El Paso Republican who didn't vote for him in 2016 because he felt insulted by the president's disparagement of Mexicans and didn't plan to vote for him this year either because of his treatment of immigrant families at the border. I can't vote for a president that looks down on me because I'm Mexican, he said, who I truly and genuinely believe is a racist. I couldn't do it. But most other Republicans we spoke with remained loyal to Trump. They did not take his comments about immigrants seriously or personally, even if they came from immigrant families themselves, and they felt the media often took his words out of context. These voters may have disagreed with some of Trump's policy positions and personality traits, but they felt that his overall values aligned with their own, and they didn't feel the Democrats were giving them better options. So what sense do we make of Latino voters? When my colleagues and I launched our study more than a year ago, we were eager to complete our first set of interviews in Houston, thinking that would get us closer to answering this question. But every one of those 21 conversations seemed to open up a new set of ideas, a different angle on the issues we were hoping to clarify. A wise Spanish proverb came to mind, Cada cabeza es un mundo. Every head is a world unto itself. That seemed eminently true about Latino voters, as it likely is about all voters, the groupings and labels we create to talk about U.S. politics and to drive electoral outcomes or loose constructions that obscure the many ways that citizens make sense of their government and the issues they care about. Latino voters are not a monolith. We didn't find a single way of being Latino, much less a Latino voter. One common thread we did find is that Latinos are by and large informed, independent political thinkers whom our political system hasn't properly understood or engaged, and making that happen begins with something quite simple, listening. We were surprised by how powerful this tool turned out to be. It's what we regularly do as social scientists, and it's what I do as a journalist. But in the realm of representative government, it's sorely missing. For many of our interviewees, just being heard was visibly empowering. And though we were there only to ask about their views, not to encourage them to vote, a few non-voters we spoke with cast a ballot in this year's primaries, motivated, they said, by the conversation we'd had months earlier. As for the sleeping giant metaphor, my colleagues and I came to see it as vastly misleading. Latino voters aren't sleeping, and most of them are following politics, and they voiced strong personal opinions when we created space for those opinions to be heard. Many of them simply didn't feel like full citizens or players in the system. They won't wake up and mobilize overnight when the right candidate or election comes along. They are a constituency in the making, gradually being engaged by the political system and empowered in society. If you've taken the time to see what Hispanics really want, all they really want is somebody to listen to them, said Claudia, who had been the first of our 104 interviewees. You might not even be what they want in a candidate, but as long as you listen to them and give them that attention and respect, they'll respect you just for that. And you might even get their vote. Claudia's sermons made an impression on her parents, too, and with her help, they registered and voted for the first time in 2004. Now, they eagerly follow political news and ask her when the next election is coming up so they can make their voice heard. As for Peter, he too is now thinking differently. Our interview last year prompted him to reconsider the importance of voting. Previously, he concluded that the Electoral College made his vote meaningless. Hillary Clinton's loss to Trump, despite winning the popular vote, made him cynical. But now, he was open to persuasion again, especially since, given his health struggles, the coronavirus pandemic had left him feeling vulnerable and exposed. After reaching out to his mother-in-law and a couple of friends, he finally decided that this year he'll go back to the polls. "I'm able to change my mind about voting," he told me. "I would love to see somebody that has the knowledge and the responsibility to be in the office help our nation out once again." The quotes in this story have been edited for clarity and space. And let's see if we've got time for something else here. All right, we'll hit real quick this best of the web for this month. Meanwhile, over on the internet, meet how Danny Trejo built a decades-long film career after prison. Stuck in solitary confinement in a California prison in 1968, Danny Trejo made a deal with God. "Just let me die with dignity and I'll say your name every day," he recalls praying. Kat Cardenas charts his journey from incarceration to Hollywood stardom, including his leading role in the Machete series directed by San Antonio-born Robert Rodriguez. The road to becoming a first-generation bull rider. Riding school in Tomball aims to train the next crop of rodeo cowboys and cowgirls. Three of its pint-sized students have big dreams of riding bucking bulls. In the first installment of Texas Monthly's new Being Texas video series, director Chris Beyer follows J.J. Hunter, who's 8 years old, as well as Jamarian and Jaden Henderson, 9 and 11 years, as they take their first rides. Shelley Luther is still campaigning to reopen Texas. The Dallas hair salon owner seized the public spotlight this spring after defying Governor Greg Abbott's COVID-19 orders, which shuttered some businesses to slow the spread of the virus. Now, Peter Holly reports, she's facing a Republican opponent for a seat in the Texas Senate, and while the pandemic restrictions have changed, her critique of Abbott hasn't. Will suburban women, Texas women give Joe Biden a boost? In 2018 midterms, many lifelong Republican women voted for Democrats. Mimi Schwartz reports on how the pandemic, President Trump, and recent protests for racial justice might further that shift. A man cycling the state's 3,000-plus-mile perimeter. After riding his bike down every street in Austin, about 4,900 miles in all, Aaron Chamberlain began looking for his next challenge. He settled on circumnavigating Texas, a feat that, as far as he could tell, no one had done before. In weekly posts chronicling his tour to Texas, he provides updates on his progress as well as what he's learning along the way. And how to smoke tasty turkey legs. You may not be able to stroll through the State Fair of Texas's cattle barns this year, but you can still enjoy the fair's fare. Barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn walks you through how to smoke succulent turkey legs at home. And that brings us to the end of our reading for today. Listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturdays at 5 and Mondays at 2, both p.m. on site and to sound broadcasting, your print information source.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Clinics offer coronavirus tests. Midland Memorial Hospital, 68 nurse. MidlandHealth.org, mobile testing center at West Campus for COVID-19 nasal swab PCR. Must call for appointment. Antibody testing at West Campus or Main Campus Direct Access, 68 nurse or 221-1111. Cash prize for antibody testing, $50.
Now airing on the Noon Book Hour, we continue our Thanksgiving series with Turkey Day Murder by Leslie Meyer. Tinker's Cove, Maine has a long history of Thanksgiving festivities, from visits with Tom Tom Turkey to the annual Warriors High School football game and Lucy Stone's impressive pumpkin pie. But this year, someone has added murder to the menu, and Lucy intends to discover who left Metinicut Indian activist Kurt Nolan dead with an ancient war club next to his head. The list of suspects isn't brief. Nolan had a habit of disagreeing with just about everybody. Between fixing dinner for 12 and keeping her four kids from tearing each other limb from limb, Lucy has a pretty full plate already. So what's a little investigation? But if she's not careful, she may find herself served up as a last-minute course. Stone cold dead with all the trimmings. Turkey Day Murder by Leslie Meyer. Weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
We'll be right back. Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the November issue of Texas Highways, and our first one is titled, One Giant Leap of Faith. On the 25th anniversary of NASA mission STS-63, astronaut Bernard Harris Jr. reflects on his pioneering journey to become the first African-American to walk in space. By Michael Hurd. 213 nautical miles above the Earth, Bernard Harris Jr. had an unobstructed celestial view as he floated out of the space shuttle Discovery hatch and into history. But his noticeable pause, for a little bit, as he recalled, prompted NASA's mission control to ask, "Why are you doing that?" Harris was marveling at his surroundings as Space Shuttle Discovery orbited at a dizzying 17,000 miles an hour, circling Earth once every 90 minutes. He gathered himself and quickly responded, "Oh, nothing." But the unfolding event was very much something. Mission STS-63, which launched February 3, 1995, broke ground in many ways. It marked the first rendezvous of the American space shuttle with Russia's space station Mir. Also on board, Eileen Collins, an American, became the first woman to pilot a space shuttle. And C. Michael Foal became the first British-born American astronaut to walk in space. And for Payload Commander Harris, who was on his second and final NASA mission, it was the improbable realization of a childhood dream, as he became the first African American to walk in space on February 9, 1995. The little boy, who was forced to use the back door of a Waco diner in the 60s because of his race, had triumphed in the 90s, he wrote in his 2010 memoir, Dreamwalker. "It was my day, and I was flying pretty high." Harris, born in Temple in 1956 and now based in Houston, grew up a big fan of all things science fiction, from Buck Rogers to Star Trek. The 1969 Apollo 11 spectacle was must-see TV for Harris, though a continuing social drama hovered in the background as black Americans fought hard for civil rights. They marched, protested, sat in, and rioted, burn, baby, burn, for most of the decade that neared its end with Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon. The watershed moment fully captured the world's imagination and instantly cemented the career aspirations of 13-year-old Harris, despite the racial unrest he saw on TV and his everyday life. "I could see human beings accomplishing one of the greatest feats in the world, but I could change the channel and see our people being disgraced, dogs sicked on them, water cannons spraying them," Harris recalled in a 2019 Houston Public Media interview. "To decide, despite what I saw, that I wanted to be an astronaut was a big leap of faith." When I interviewed Harris earlier this year, he described his innate drive to succeed in spite of the segregated and hostile racial climate of the 60s as an inherited family trait. His mother, Gussie Harris, bolstered his dreams by insisting he could be whatever he wanted, no matter that he grew up poor. Harris's family moved to Houston shortly after he was born. They lived there until he was six, when Gussie and Bernard Harris Sr. divorced, and Gussie took her three children back to Temple. She had a home economics degree from Prairie View A&M University and a desire to teach, but no local teaching offers came in. So she uprooted the family and drove more than 1,000 miles to Greasewood, Arizona, to teach at a boarding school on the Navajo Nation Reservation. During the summers, the family would retreat to Texas, where Gussie met and married Joe Burgess, a police officer. Harris said his new father figure helped bring stability to a family set on accomplishing goals. There are certain characteristics you're born with, and mine was wanting to do things that people hadn't done before, Harris explained. Once I had it in my mind that I wanted to go into space, I was not going to be deterred. Looking at television and seeing the box they were trying to paint us in as African Americans, I was saying, "It's not going to happen here. That's not going to determine my dream." Harris's experience growing up in the Heights neighborhood near downtown Houston, where, quote, not a lot of kids made it out, proved critical to his character development. It instilled in him a determination to give back to the black community, especially kids searching for hope. Because Harris's biggest obstacle to realizing his space dreams was his race, he now works to help minority kids obtain STEM educations as CEO of the National Math and Science Initiative. The Dallas-based organization operates programs designed to boost the number of STEM teachers, increase student access to advanced placement courses, and train existing teachers. Against the backdrop of the national dialogue on racial injustice, Harris spends most of his day now conversing with educational leaders and corporate executives who want to know how they can make the system more inclusive. "I see this as an opportunity for those who didn't believe that systemic racism exists to see that it's been a black and white issue for a long time," Harris said. "Now it's in full color in their faces, and they see the issues that minorities have dealt with for all these years, particularly in the black community. It's raised the awareness, and people are reacting in a positive way, saying, we've got to change. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard," President John F. Kennedy said in a speech at Houston's Rice University on September 12, 1962. 7 years after Kennedy's imperative words, pushing for a manned lunar landing, Harris sat rapt as one of the most important moments in all of history played out on his family's small black-and-white TV screen in Tehachapi, New Mexico, where they'd moved in 1967. Armstrong walking on the moon instantly inspired a young Harris, though he did not yet know the astronaut corps and NASA in general were all white fraternities. In 1961, Alan Shepard was the first American to travel into space. It would be 22 years before Gwynne Bluford would become the first African-American astronaut to travel into space. Bluford was a member of STS-8, the third space shuttle Challenger mission, which conducted the first night launch and night landing. In between Armstrong's and Bluford's missions, black community leaders, especially in Houston, where the Johnson Space Center is located, push NASA to hire astronauts of color. As a young Harris came to understand NASA's lack of diversity, he rarely mentioned his goal in public. Early on in the program in the 60s, we were, as African Americans, fighting just for the right to vote and to be included, Harris recalled. So the idea of sharing my dream meant having people tell you, "There are no blacks at NASA. What makes you think you can become an astronaut?" So I held it closely to the chest. That is, until he attended the University of Houston, where his Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity brothers could see the stars in his eyes. His close friend, Gerald McElvey, now a regent with the University of Houston system and former president of the ExxonMobil Foundation, described what they saw in the future spaceman. "He was very impressive and carried himself well," McElvey said. "He had very high aspirations, as did I, and we talk about doing something significant together in the future, though we didn't define it or know what it was. He distinguished himself as one of the more intellectual members of the group, and at times would say something that flew over everybody's head, and one time someone said, Would you beam me up, Scotty? Following the University of Houston and Texas Tech Medical School, Harris got his first big break during a residency in internal medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. His first rotation was in rheumatology, with Dr. Joseph Combs, who mentioned the clinic had created the field of aerospace medicine for the early space program. An eager Harris shared his NASA aspirations, and Combs introduced him to the head of the aerospace medicine program.